the closest legislative race got a lot closer when the first batch of absentee ballots were counted today. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the story of one homeless teen in Anchorage who ended up at Covenant House.
He was told all his life that he'd been abandoned in a shed in Alaska when he was 6 months old and then adopted out to a family that had severe domestic violence problems.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
Two votes. That's the latest report from Juneau, where absentee ballots were counted today in the race for House District 34. Haines Republican Representative Bill Thomas now holds a two-vote lead over Sitka Democrat Jonathan Kreis Tompkins. Here are the new totals from Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai. Bill Thomas, 4,054. Jonathan Kreis Tompkins, 4,052. Kreis Tompkins watched the absentee ballot count in person today.
It's monotonous. It's literally feeding a ballot counter thousands of paper stock ballots.
But the counting isn't over. More ballots could still arrive by mail. Two more count dates are on the calendar, and anything can happen.
There are, I think, 167 absentee ballots that were requested but haven't come in by mail yet. So at least a couple of those, probably some kind of percentage of those will come in by mail, and who knows what way they're going to swing.
There are also our three question ballots from Port Alexander left to count. Thomas also reached by phone in Juneau, called the election a seesaw, and reiterated his worry about Southeast's clout in the next legislative session. He says he'll have a seat on finance, but has already lost the chairmanship. And he noted that Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, though returned to office by voters, will no longer be co-chair of Senate Finance.
Very rarely has a district ever lost two co-chairs of finance in the history of the state. I think this might be the first time. You know, we're going to have to fight hard to get over it one way or the other. It'll put more work on either Jonathan or I. We'll have to work pretty hard, and I think there's less capital this year and more people that want it. So either way, it's going to be a tough battle for whoever.
Additional ballot counts for absentee votes that have yet to arrive by mail are set for November 16th and 21st. Election workers were also scanning hundreds of absentee and question ballots at the Division of Elections office in Anchorage today. Four workers fed stacks of paper ballots into AccuVote machines. That there is one Senate race and one House race in Anchorage that are too close to call. In the House race, Republican Lance Pruitt is now leading Democrat Pete Peterson by 216 votes, increasing his margin of victory by 120 votes. Pruitt was recently named House Majority Leader. The Division of Elections has not yet updated results for the Senate race between incumbent Democrat Hollis French and Republican Bob Bell. French holds a lead of 247 votes in that race. Congress reconvenes today after more than a month away. With less than 2 months until the end of the year and the close of the session, members clearly feel the heat. Today, the Senate picked up a collection of bills known as the Sportsman's Package. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, if it passes, it could waive the duck stamp fee for subsistence hunters.
The Sportsman's Package was mired in political controversy before Congress took off. Montana Democratic Senator John Tester introduced the bill in the upper chamber, while his opponent in the recent election, Republican Denny Rehberg introduced a similar version in the House. Tester won the election, and today the Senate voted to pass his bill through procedural hurdles. The package has a whole host of provisions, from allowing hunters to carry bows through national parks, to reauthorizing various conservation acts, to changing the federal duck stamp program.
It will be nice to get some sort of clarity.
That's Aurora Lair. She works on federal policy for the Alaska Federation of Natives. Subsistence hunters are required to purchase duck stamps, the federal permit for hunting migratory birds and waterfowl. Lair says many Alaskan natives never knew a rule existed, so they unwittingly broke the law. A provision in the sportsman's package would allow the Secretary of Interior to waive the purchase of duck stamps for certain people. It does not specify who or what the criteria would be, but Lair says she's confident subsistence hunters will qualify, in part because Secretary Ken Salazar has expressed support for the measure in meetings with AFN leaders.
There hasn't been any sort of commitment, but it's something that he and his staff have been supportive of through our conversations with them.
A duck stamp costs $15, not a lot of money for most sport hunters, but in some Alaska communities, a hefty sum. Paul Schmidt is the chief conservationist at Ducks Unlimited, the lobby association working to preserve waterfowl habitats. His group supports the entire sportsman's package, but would like to see as few waivers granted as possible. The government uses the money to buy up critical habitats for waterfowl.
As long as they are reasonable and don't begin to erode the whole program, that fundamentally is important to habitat conservation.
Schmidt says subsistence hunters in Alaska are a worthy candidate to receive the waiver. Since 1934, when the duck stamp program was established, the U.S. government has bought up 5 million acres. None of it has been in Alaska. And that's okay with U.S. Senator Mark Begich.
We have a lot of land already, as you know, preserved and owned by the federal government. So I'm not sure I want more land in their control. But I think what's more important is that there is resources available for protecting and ensuring this habitat for duck hunting and subsistence hunters is, you know, there in perpetuity.
And the bill could assure resources are coming down the pike. It would require the Secretary of Interior to consider changing the price of a duck stamp every 3 years. It's been $15 since 1991. That's the longest stretch of time without a price increase. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The subsistence fishermen trials that were scheduled to start today in Bethel have been postponed. From KYUK, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
Defense attorney James Davis Jr. requested more time to consolidate the trials of all remaining fishermen and to bring in a new witness, Yupik culture expert Chase Hensel. According to the defense, Hensel is expected to testify as to how and why subsistence fishing should be protected under the First Amendment to the Alaska Constitution. Hensel has agreed to act as a pro bono expert in all cases. 11 fishermen were scheduled to stand trial November 13th and 14th, and 10 more are scheduled for trial in January. Last month, 3 fishermen were found guilty in Bethel Court of fishing with illegal gear during the low king salmon run in June. The defense argued that the fishermen were not properly notified of the fishing restrictions, which changed throughout June. The court sided with the state, maintaining that the fishermen were properly notified through radio announcements, faxes, and orders presented in villages. The court said the fishermen were negligent, and it was their responsibility to be informed. 2 fishermen were fined $250 and put on 1-year probation. 1 fisherman paid $350 without probation. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Another Fort Wainwright soldier has been convicted of charges related to the death of a fellow Stryker Brigade member last year in Afghanistan. Sergeant Jeffrey Hurst was found guilty of 1 count of dereliction of duty at a court-martial trial at Fort Bragg, North Carolina on Friday. According to an Army press release, Hurst was sentenced to a rank reduction and 45 days of hard labor for his role in the mistreatment of Private Danny Chen. Chen was found dead of an apparent suicide suicide in a guard tower at a forward operating post in Afghanistan after enduring weeks of physical and verbal abuse by fellow soldiers. Eight soldiers were originally charged in Chen's death. Six have now been sentenced in the case. The remaining two, Lieutenant Daniel Schwartz and Sergeant Andrew Van Bokel, are scheduled for court-martials in the Chen case. Van Bokel's trial starts tomorrow at Fort Bragg. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new road in Fairbanks that was decades in the making.
Just going to make town make sense instead of the way the streets kind of were all confusing before. Now at least we'll be able to know which way to go.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The new book, Almost Home, profiles the lives of six young people who experienced homelessness and found help and a path toward a brighter future through Covenant House, a national network of shelters for homeless teens. The book was written by the president of Covenant House, Kevin Ryan, and a former New York Times reporter, Tina Kelly, who is also a past volunteer at one of the shelters. The first profile in the book is of an Alaskan, a young man named Polly. Tina Kelly says they were impressed by his graciousness and how he gave back to the community after a very tough start to life.
He was told all his life that he'd been abandoned in a shed in Alaska when he was 6 months old and basically left for dead, and then adopted out through the child welfare system to a family that had severe domestic violence problems. When he was 13, his family imploded. His mother moved to Canada with a new boyfriend, and he didn't get along well with his father. So from when he was about 15 till 20 or 21, he went from couch to couch. He became addicted to drugs. He spent time in McLaughlin. He had a really, really rough adolescence. And through the help of one particular social worker that we focus on in the book named Mildred Mack, he got the tough love he needed, and he was in and out of our shelter 11 different times, but by the 11th time, her voice had sort of become his internal conscience. And he decided that, yes, it was time for him to quit staying out all night partying. It was time for him to get his GED and to start thinking about his future.
Well, Kevin, I'll turn back to you now. How would you say the homeless youth situation in Anchorage compares or differs from other cities?
Well, there's not another city that Covenant House works in with this experience of Arctic homelessness, where young people confront not just the soulful despair of feeling alone in the world and not having a place to turn and wondering why they're alone in the world, wondering why their families don't love them or care for them, but they're also freezing. And I spent with Tina years talking with Paulie about how he did that, moving from couch to couch, spiraling into the rave scene here in town, all-night dance parties, using X, which is a drug that warms the body, and which lots of young people in the rave scene, at that time at least, were using, but all which profoundly struck him down, caused him to lose direction in the world. So he would, from time to time, come into Covenant House, but he wasn't ready to make the kinds of decisions that young people have to make in order to do well in the world. He was filled with self-pity. And what Mildred offered him, because they just did not like each other for the longest time. She is an older African-American social worker who was left by her husband to raise two kids here in Alaska, and she was the last person in the world to purr or sweet talk or hug. She was very much about discipline and organization, and she was firm. And he was this charismatic, charming, athletic, somewhat spoiled, and certainly self-pitying adolescent. And he resisted at every turn her coaching, and she resisted his a voracious appetite for self-absorption and pity. And so they clashed over and over and over again. And she clashed with him in a loving way, challenging him, you got to get back into school. You got to get off the drugs. And as Tina said, there was just this point in his life where he was going nowhere and was freezing and lost. And all he could hear in his mind's eye was this voice of Mildred saying, you're better than this. And you need to make different, better choices. And years ago, when he gave back to the community in a rather profound way by helping to celebrate a holiday meal for homeless young people who were still living at the shelter he'd left and was now in his 20s, he stood up in front of a large crowd and said that although Mildred Mack was the toughest and sometimes the meanest voice that he could remember in his adolescence, that it was the voice that changed his life.
Sort of a mom voice, whether he wanted to admit it or not.
That's exactly right.
That seems to kind of strike a hopeful note that even children that some may say, well, by the time they're 8 or 9 years old, if you haven't been able to help them, it's just going to be too late. After that point, they're sort of ruined for life. And obviously, these stories show us that's not the case.
That's just not true. And one of the most hopeful things about reporting the book was discovering the ways in which young people in their teen years, even if they feel so much like the walking wounded, can embrace something good in the world and move forward. One of the happy surprises in the book, our book is bookended by stories of survival in Alaska, the Pauly story. But we didn't expect that it was going to be bookended by Pauly's story. We thought Pauly's story would begin the book and it would end there. But midway through the reporting of the book, Pauly received a Facebook message from a woman who said, I'm your birth mother, this woman who he had heard long ago had abandoned him in a shed. And, you know, Tina, the steady, experienced New York Times journalist, steadied my hand because I thought, what are we going to do now? And they invited Tina to report on their reunion, which occurred in the Midwest. And he learned some new truths about himself, and she learned some truths about him. And Tina, I'll leave it to you to talk about the way that touched your heart, because Tina herself is an adopted child and so found it, I think, moving in a personal way to discover that reunion.
It was wild to see them talking to each other and comparing facial features. You know, he said, you know, I have your chin, but I don't have your nose. And where did I get this nose from? I hate my nose. Who's his birth father? And their interactions together were so sweet. It made me really admire Pauly for his social graces, because it could have been a very awkward situation. It could have been awkward for them to have an observer there, but they were very welcoming. And I kept thinking about all these missed turns where she'd been counseled not to keep her child because she was 16 at the time, he was 2, and she was homeless. And she went down a spiral of grief and had a very difficult adulthood, in part because she was grieving for him. And he had a very difficult placement where he grew up in an adoptive family that didn't work out for him. And I felt so lucky in contrast, because my parents raised me in a very warm and loving home. And it just made me think it's really a lottery when you're born onto this planet as to who you end up with.
Kevin Ryan and Tina Kelly are the co-authors of Almost Home, Helping Kids Move from Homelessness to Hope. A longer version of the interview and links to the book are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Tonight, Covenant House is holding a solidarity sleepout to bring attention to the problem of homeless youth. Activists will be sleeping outside near Covenant House in downtown Anchorage for periods of time throughout the night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, NA. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
Fishery managers and stakeholders across the state are expressing concern about the lackluster king salmon runs this year in Alaska, but the third largest king run in the state appears healthy. KDLG's Mike Mason explains.
The King Salmon Run to the Nooshigak River in Bristol Bay is the largest king run in the bay and the third largest king run in the state. The escapement goal is 75,000 kings, and this year, actual escapement was counted at 107,000 fish. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game normally produces an actual king salmon forecast, but for the past couple of years, they've foregone an actual forecast and opted for a commercial harvest projection. Greg Buck is the Fish and Game Assistant Area Research Biologist.
We think last year was a pretty strong run. I think everybody knows that, and I think we're kind of on track for probably a little bit more of the same. I think I'm comfortable saying that much. We had a very strong age 1-3 component return this year, and so I would expect a similar age 1-4 return next year.
Buck confirms the run forecast model has not performed well in recent years, which has resulted in the decision to not put out an actual forecast. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is in the midst of a 3-year project to gather additional information that should help clarify the migratory patterns of kings in the Nooshigak River and provide additional data that can be incorporated into the run forecast models. Buck says the results of the acoustic tagging project are not yet known.
A lot of that data hasn't been analyzed yet. We've got one more year of the project, so it will be a while before some of that is analyzed. But as of now, the project is working as advertised. We've put in as many tags as we wanted to, and at least in 2011, we got good amount of data out of those tags. 2012, we haven't analyzed yet, but we put out as many tags as we wanted, and it looked like all the equipment operated.
Buck says about 400 tags were deployed on kings over the last couple of years, and the project will continue again in 2013. The anticipated commercial harvest of Nooshigak River kings next year is 45,000 fish, and it's anticipated that most, if not all, of those kings will be caught incidentally in the commercial fishery targeting sockeye. It's unknown if there will be any directed commercial openings targeting king salmon next year. There were no such openings this year, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has been cautious in recent years in allowing a commercial fishery specifically targeting the kings bound for the Nooshigak River. Last year, just 11.4 thousand kings were harvested in the Nooshigak District, which is the lowest number in the last 10 years. The largest commercial harvest was over 96,000 kings back in 2004. In the narrative of the 2013 Nooshigak River Chinook salmon harvest projection, the authors note that even with the difficulties in assessing and forecasting the total run, they believe the 2013 run will be large enough to meet the in-river goal and provide for commercial sport and subsistence harvest opportunities. You can find the harvest projection on the ADF&G Bristol Bay website. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
It's a lot easier to navigate downtown Fairbanks after 2 years of construction. A long-awaited new road and bridge in the city center opened yesterday. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The timing played out right as the new Veterans Memorial Bridge opened in Fairbanks Monday, a day after the official Veterans Day holiday. Fairbanksans turned out on a below-zero afternoon to celebrate the opening of the downtown bridge over the Chena River. A procession of antique cars carrying past military service members drove through a red ribbon to open the new bridge. It's the centerpiece of a $23 million overhaul and realignment of Illinois Street, a project aimed at making downtown safer and easier to navigate for motorists and pedestrians. Retired state transportation planner Jerry Rafson was on hand to watch the opening, noting its effect untangling traffic.
Just going to make town make sense. Instead of the way the streets kind of were all confusing before, now at least we'll be able to know which way to go.
Illinois Street reconstruction was more than 3 decades in planning. In post-ribbon-cutting remarks, Mayor Jerry Cleworth said the project predates the start of his long tenure with the city.
First got on the city council in 1987, and they said this would be done, in a couple years. And it had been talked about prior to that. I think it was about, in the mid-90s, I kind of gave up on it. But it's amazing to see it finally come to fruition.
State Department of Transportation Northern Region Director Steve Titus points to a mix of factors coming together in recent years, which allowed the Illinois Street project to finally go to construction.
There was a lot of studies that they worked from, and a couple concepts were abandoned, and then there was some environmental documents that had to be completed, and all of those things take a lot of time. And then getting the money as well, it's not small chump change by any means.
Once underway, Illinois Street reconstruction moved faster than expected. Welcome news to downtown business owners, some of whom saw greatly reduced traffic due to season-long detours. John Jakovich owns the historic Big Eye Bar right in the middle of the construction zone.
You know, we just held our breath and just said, keep doing what you're doing. And when people had a complaint or maybe felt a little put out, I kept trying to encourage everybody to keep your head up. Nobody's in this deeper than I am right now.
The Illinois Street overhaul includes development of new green space along the Chena River and specialized stormwater handling and natural bank restoration to protect fish and wildlife habitat. The last portion of the project, replacement of the Noyes Slough Bridge at the other end of Illinois Street, will be completed next summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Preparations continue for next year's rededication of Chief Shake's Tribal House, but the people in charge of the event have hit a snag, making sure there's enough housing. KSTK's Ariel Van Cleve has the story.
Wrangell's hotels, B&Bs, and lodges are booked solid for the celebration set for May 3rd and 4th, and that's still about 6 months away. As of right now, the Wrangell Cooperative Association, which is spearheading planning for the event, expects more than 700 people to attend. But WCA's Tis Peterman says those are mainly dancers. She says the number of possible attendees continues to climb as word of the event spreads.
And a story about this went statewide that KSTK did, and a local B&B owner calls me up and she said, "What happened this week?" She said, "My phone has been ringing off the hook all day long."
Peterman says the WCA started looking to more unconventional options for housing.
We did have a letter requesting a ferry to be docked here for housing during the rededication to the governor and to the head of the Alaska Marine Highway. They were denied.
She says the request was denied due to issues with liability, a lack of precedence, and scheduling conflicts. Now the WCA office is seeking help from the community. Peterman says they've received about 20 responses so far.
But we're going to need a lot more before this is over. We just did some letters to the churches, to Forest Service, to, I think we're going to ask the National Guard Armory, maybe if they could put up a few there. But still, I think we're going to be woefully short.
Peterman says she's hopeful the community will come together to ensure all visitors have a place to lay their head. For now, the office is looking for anyone with spare rooms, apartments, or even RVs for rent. In Wrangell, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ariel Van Cleve in Wrangell. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time homebuyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.